I'm a little boy with glasses, the one they call a geek. A little girl who never smiles, cause I've got braces on my teeth. And I know how it feels to cry myself to sleep. I'm that kid on every playground who's always chosen last. A single teenage mother trying to overcome my past. You don't have to be my friend. Is it too much to ask? Don't laugh at me. Don't call me names. Don't get your pleasure from my pain. In God's eyes, we're all. Triple on the corner, you pass me on the street. I wouldn't be out here begging if I had enough to eat. And don't think I don't notice that I rise never leave. I lost my wife and little boy. Someone crossed that yellow line. The day we laid them in the ground is the day I lost my mind. And right now I'm down to hold this little cardboard sign. So don't laugh at me. Don't call me names. Don't get your pleasure from my pain. In God's eyes, we're all.
And that's right. Don't laugh at me. This here is Big Dot, better known as Missionary Kenneth Wolfgang, with you on another Jumbo Braille program here on the Success Radio Network, the one and only program here on the Success Radio Network that can be felt. And we want to say welcome one, welcome all to the program today, especially our surrounding city and states, our countries near and far, as well as those who called 515-605-9340. Again, 515-605-9340. Just press the number one, join the conversation. We'll be glad to hear from you. Amen. And we got another book today that will be just now starting book three of course, the Coulter Family Historical Books by Katherine Anderson. We'll hear a little bit more about that. But first off, Ghost Dot, who do we got with us today?
We got the Father, Son, Holy Ghost, Band of Angels. We have you, me. That's it.
Okay. Well, with us, we will be getting into this book today. But basically, it's now book three, and this will be about Eden Paxton and a guy, Matthew Coulter. So we won't be able to give you much detail other than that so far because it is the beginning of the book. So Ghost Dot, give us the preliminaries, and we'll go get right into the book today, and then we'll be able to find out more about what happens in this book.
Tonight, we'll be reading the Coulter Family Historical Books Early Dawn by Katherine Anderson, Book 3, read by Jill Fox. Prologue, Chapters 1 and 2. Take it away, Kenny, on the Six Eyes Radio Network. Yeah.
Prologue, June 1887. Matthew Calder awakened to a soft hissing sound, the faint smell of kerosene, and the dim glow of lantern light. A nearly blinding pain knifed from his left eyebrow into his temple, and as he struggled to focus, he was filled with a terrible sense of dread. When his eyes had adjusted, he realized that he was abed in his childhood sleeping nook, a rectangular space with rough plank walls that was barely large enough to hold a cot, battered dresser, and small wardrobe. Strange. He'd been married 5 years ago and hadn't stayed overnight at his folks' place since. But there was no mistake. The familiar scent of his mother's Irish stew drifted in from the kitchen to tease his nostrils. The air redolent with pan-browned lamb chops simmered to perfection. And the unmistakable fragrance of thyme, a spice his wife Olivia seldom used. Matthew yearned to slip back into the darkness of sleep that had so recently enveloped him. But that niggling sense of dread grew stronger as he came more awake. Something was wrong, horribly wrong. But his head hurt so badly that he couldn't remember what. "Ma," he croaked, and pushed up onto one elbow with a low groan, because a sharp stitch in his side nearly took his breath away. The room spun around him, the shadows that lurked beyond the sphere of light seeming to dance and sway. He wrapped a hand over the mattress edge to keep from pitching off onto the floor. What in Sam Hill? It felt as if every bone in his body had been broken, and the pain in his temple throbbed with each beat of his heart. "Ah!" A blurry female figure dressed in blue appeared in the archway. "Matthew, thank God!" The lilt of her faint Irish brogue was as familiar to Matthew as his own voice. "We were starting to think you might never wake up." Matthew lay back against the pillow and closed his eyes as his mother sat beside him and placed a cool, soothing hand on his right cheek. The gesture reminded him of the early days of his childhood, when she checked him for fever or fussed over him when he was sick. He let himself enjoy the sensation for a moment before prying his eyes open again to fix his gaze on her face. Even at 56, Hattie Calder was a lovely woman, with black hair and eyes the deep blue of a summer sky. The years had lined her skin, but on her the traces of age were like the tiny cracks on the surface of an old oil painting, only adding to its beauty. "Where's Livy?" Matthew asked hoarsely. She withdrew her hand from his cheek and brought it to rest on her lap in a tight fist. Matthew knew then that something really was amiss. The thought that it might involve his wife filled him with panic. "Ma," he pressed, "where's Olivia?" Hattie pushed to her feet. "I'll be back in a moment, dear heart. I need to tell your father that you're awake." Matthew watched her hurry from the room. Something dark hovered at the back of his mind, something so ominous and unthinkable that he didn't want to acknowledge it. He flung his forearm over his eyes to shield them from the light and immediately regretted it when pain exploded in his left temple. Gingerly, he explored with numb fingertips to discover that his head was wrapped in gauze. An injury of some sort? He couldn't recall having an accident, but after working with horses most of his life, he knew he might not remember if he'd been kicked in the head. Matthew had almost convinced himself of a horse's kick when he heard the heavy tattoo of his father's boots on the kitchen floor. An instant later, Matthew Calder Sr. filled the doorway, his weather-bronzed face creased with worry, his blue eyes shadowed with sadness. He slowly approached the bed, his wife hovering behind him. In that no-nonsense way of his, he wasted no time hemming and hawing. In a brogue much more pronounced than his wife's, he said, "Your ma says you don't remember what happened, son, that you've been asking where Olivia is." He cleared his throat. "You need to brace yourself, boy, because I can't think of no easy way to say this, and I ain't good with words at the best of times. Your Livy was killed by a gang of ruffians. Happened nigh on to 3 weeks ago now." "What?" Matthew couldn't wrap his mind around the words bouncing inside his head. He pictured Olivia's precious face, her soft brown eyes and gentle smile. Dead? She was so young. That couldn't be. His father had to have it wrong. No, Matthew grated out. No! His father shook his head and sank heavily onto the edge of the bed. I'm sorry, son. It pains me more than you can know to be the one to tell you such a thing. We loved her too, your ma and me. She was like a daughter to us. Though the discomfort was excruciating, Matthew shook his head in denial. No. Even as he whispered the word, Matthew knew by the dark sorrow in his father's eyes that it was true. Olivia was dead. The ensuing silence drove that home to him. His ma didn't interrupt to say that his pa had it wrong, nor did she offer Matthew any assurance that everything would come right in the end. How? Matthew forced himself to ask. Ruffians? We don't have... It's safe hereabouts. The sheriff says it was the Sebastian gang. Matthew Sr. cleared his throat. You've heard tell of them. We read about them in the Crystal Falls Courier a few months back. A couple of days after the attack on you and Livy, they struck again over near Medford, shot a boy dead for trying to stop them from stealing some horses. Them Sebastians are wanted damn near everywhere west of the Divide. A posse out of Sacramento was hot on their heels, and the gang took a detour through here, trying to shake them off. The elder man's voice had gone almost as hoarse as Matthew's. You and Livy. Well, near as we could tell, he was on the way home from a picnic by the creek. The gang must have come out of the trees, all of a sudden-like, and surrounded your wagon. You wasn't armed, and there wasn't much you could do. Livy, she was... He broke off as if the words had stuck in his throat. Then he passed a gnarled, work-roughened hand over his craggy face. Well, we can only pray she went quick and didn't suffer over much. Doc believes you was already unconscious by the wagon when it happened. Pistol whipped, kicked after you went down, and then shot in the chest and left for dead. Doc did all he could, but you was in sorry shape with busted up ribs, a hole near your heart, and an injury to your head he couldn't fix. If not for your ma's prayers and nursing, we might have lost you, too. Wringing her hands in her apron, Matthew's mother moved closer to the cot. It's true, dear heart. I've barely slept a wink since they brought you in. It's been touch and go. We were afraid you might never come back around. Matthew wished he hadn't. His sweet Livy dead? He didn't want to believe it. How could something like that have happened, and he had no memory of it? Embarrassed to lose control in front of his father, Matthew rolled onto his stomach and pressed his face into the pillow to stifle his sobs. Even though the pressure against his temple hurt like hell. Have a care, Matthew, his mother cried. You'll reopen your wounds. But Matthew was beyond caring about his wounds. He hoped they'd break open so he could bleed to death. Livy. On their wedding day, he'd vowed to keep her safe from all harm, and he'd failed her in a way no husband ever should, all because he hadn't taken a weapon with him on a stupid picnic. He felt his father's hand come to rest on his shoulder. We'll leave you be for a bit. There's times when a man needs to be alone, and I reckon this is one of them for you. Matthew held his breath until his parents left the room. Then he released a sob that shook his whole body. Livy. He'd loved her since boyhood. How would he face the rest of his life without her? From the hallway, he heard his brother, Hoyt, murmur something he didn't quite catch. Matthew Sr. replied, I don't think he remembers much, and I didn't think it was a good idea to fill in the blanks just yet. No point in hitting them with too much at once. But Pa, Hoyt protested, louder now, you gotta tell him. If you don't, somebody else will say something without thinking. Better to break it to him, gentle-like. Shh! Hush, you two, Ma urged. Matthew rolled onto his back to better hear the conversation taking place in the hallway. What had his father neglected to tell him? Livy was dead. What the hell could be worse than that? Lowering his voice again, Hoyt said, His wife was brutally raped, for God's sake, and then the sons of bitches carved on her with a knife before they slit her throat. You can't keep that from him. He's bound to find out sooner or later, and it'd be easier for him to hear it from you. Maybe, his father agreed, but not this minute. That boy needs to heal some first. Matthew squeezed his eyes tightly closed. Oh, God. The memories of that afternoon were coming back to him now, fast and hard. The unthinkable darkness at the back of his mind had slipped into the light of day. He tried to block the pictures that swirled through his mind, but they just kept coming. Livy. He could see the sunlight slanting down through the tree limbs to dapple her sweet face, hear the sound of her laughter. During the picnic, she told him that she was finally in the family way, and they'd been so happy, anxious to get home so they could share their joy with his parents and hers. Then six men on horseback had spilled from the nearby woods and encircled their wagon. Oh, God. The thugs had been armed. They had demanded valuables, and neither Matthew nor Olivia had had anything to offer them. Matthew's gold pocket watch had been at the jeweler's for repairs, and Livy's wedding band hadn't been worth much. Those bastards had retaliated by dragging Olivia from the wagon. When Matthew jumped in to defend her, two of the no-account polecats had held his arms while a third man beat him senseless with the butt of his revolver. Afterward, Matthew had lain by the wagon with his face in the dirt while they kicked his torso, burying the toes of their boots as deeply as they could into his flesh to do as much damage as possible. When they'd grown weary of that sport and turned their vile intentions on Olivia, Matthew had tried desperately to move, but his body refused to cooperate. He hadn't been able to lift his head. As if from a great distance, he'd heard Livy screaming his name over and over, until finally there was an awful silence. Seconds later, one of the ruffians had returned to Matthew, rolled him over onto his back with the toe of one boot, and shot him in the chest. It was all Matthew could remember. After that was only blackness. Matthew stared through a blur of tears at the ceiling rafters, wishing with every fiber of his being that he had died too. He'd lain there in the dirt while his wife was raped and murdered. What kind of man was he? No kind of man, he decided. No kind of man at all. It took Matthew 3 more weeks to recover enough to get out of bed, and even then he wasn't anywhere close to being healed. His broken ribs hadn't mended quite right, so it still hurt to breathe deeply. The bullet wound, which had done more damage to his shoulder than his chest, had left him barely able to use his left arm. He also had a hitch in his gait caused by an injury to his right hip. When Matthew first gained his feet, he staggered around like a drunk, his head spinning, his stomach lurching with nausea. At the mirror by the wardrobe, he saw why. The gash at his temple had been deep and nearly 6 inches long. Though his hair was growing back to cover the scar, it was still a vivid red and visible through the half-inch stubble. Yet another scar slashed from above his left eyebrow to the upper part of his eyelid, the line puckered from Doc's lack of finesse with a needle and thread. Another jagged crimson line angled along his cheekbone. With trembling fingers, Matthew traced the marks. His ma had shaved him yesterday, but she may as well not have bothered. His face had never been pretty boy perfect, and now it bordered on the grotesque. The man who'd worked him over with the pistol butt must have been right-handed, Matthew decided, a fact that he filed away for later. Little wonder he felt dizzy on his feet. Head injuries like these could have killed him. The temple wound had been severe enough to affect some of his gray matter. It might take a while for his brain to right itself completely, and until then he would probably feel dizzy and sick to his stomach more times than not. Even so, Matthew was determined to be up and about. While lying helpless in bed, he'd had a lot of time to think, and he'd kept coming full circle to the undeniable fact that no man worth his salt allowed a bunch of low-life bastards to cruelly rape and murder his wife. It was too late now for Matthew to undo the events of that terrible afternoon, but as God was his witness, it wasn't too late to avenge Livy's death. Matthew managed to saddle his horse, Smokey, that first day, and ride into Crystal Falls to stock up on ammunition for his .44 caliber Winchester rifle and his Colt revolvers. Before heading back home, he stopped at the jeweler's, where he'd left his gold pocket watch for repairs a couple of weeks before the attack. The proprietor, a balding middle-aged man of considerable girth, who wore a black bib apron over a white shirt, the bosom and collar of which were polished to a high sheen, looked startled when he first saw the marks on Matthew's face. Then he nodded solemnly and placed his plump hands, palms down, on the wooden counter. "Matthew," he said by way of greeting, "glad to see you on your feet. You look like you tangled with a grizzly bear and lost the battle." "Wasn't a grizzly, and there wasn't a battle. I wish to hell there had been." The jeweler nodded again. "The wife and I attended the services. I can't begin to tell you how sorry we are about Livy. Known her since she was no bigger than a grasshopper. Such a pretty little thing, always ready with a smile to cheer people up. She'll be sorely missed." Matthew touched the brim of his Stetson, his only response. He couldn't speak of Olivia without his voice shaking. "I reckon you're here for your watch." The jeweler opened a small wooden drawer behind him and plucked out a manila packet. "Just needed a good cleaning. There'll be no charge." Matthew met the older man's gaze. "Us Coulters don't take charity, Paulson. Your time's worth something." "A dime will do it then." Matthew fished in his left hip pocket, wincing at the pain in his shoulder. He handed over the dime and grabbed the packet with his right hand. "Thanks for not selling my watch. Took me a spell to come back for it, and I know your policy is to keep things for only 30 days. No worries. I inscribed that watch for Livy right before your wedding. I know how precious it must be to you." Matthew's throat went tight. He touched the brim of his hat again and exited the shop. Once on the boardwalk, he opened the envelope and tipped the watch out onto his palm. The gold gleamed in the late summer sunlight like a puddle of freshly churned butter. His heart hurt as he flipped the watch over to read the inscription on the back. "Love always, Matthew. Forever yours, Livy. 1882. Tears blurred his vision as he slipped the timepiece into his watch pocket. Forever, he realized now, was a very long time, and he had to face it without her. With difficulty, he remounted the horse and rode slowly home, trying not to jostle his shoulder or ribs. Hoyt, 2 years his junior, met him at the ranch gate. The younger man's sun-browned face bore the Coulter stamp, a blade-like nose, Irish blue eyes, a strong jaw, and a squared, stubborn chin. In a rugged, lean way, Hoyt was a handsome man, but, like Matthew, he could never lay claim to having fine features. "You're going after him, aren't you?" Hoyt asked. Matthew nodded. "Have to. What they did can't go unpunished." "I'm going with you, then." Hoyt jerked off his battered hat and raked thick fingers through his dark brown hair. "Us Coulters stick together. It's how Pa raised us. I can't let you do this alone." Matthew sighed and rested his crossed wrists over the saddle horn. "Pa needs you and the other boys here, Hoyt. I appreciate the offer, but I can't accept. You can't take on 6 outlaws by yourself. I'll brush up on my shooting before I light out, and every day after. By the time I catch up with them, I'll be as good with my gun as they are. I'll be fine." In truth, Matthew didn't care if the bastards killed him. Without Livy, he had nothing left to live for. "You've got to stay here, where you're most needed. Pa can do without me for a few weeks. Zed and Gareth can do my share of the work for a spell. The Sebastians have stayed one step ahead of the law for a good long while, Hoyt. What makes you think I can catch up with them in only a few weeks? It may take a lot longer than that. I'm hoping not, but there you have it. You shouldn't go after him without somebody to watch your back, big brother." The way Matthew saw it, their mother already stood to lose one son. There was no point in doubling her grief by putting Hoyt's life at risk. "Should or shouldn't aside, I'm not taking you with me." Matthew reined his horse to go around his sibling. "The family needs you here." As Matthew rode toward the log stable, he trailed his gaze over the ranch. which had been dubbed the Lazy J. The name had never made a lick of sense to Matthew. There was nothing lazy about raising beeves and horses. His pa had sweat blood to clear enough land to support his growing herd of cattle, and that wasn't to mention all the hours of labor it had taken to build the roomy log home, the outbuildings, and all the fences. Even now, at almost 60, Matthew Coulter Sr. worked from the first crack of dawn until well after dark, and all four of his sons did as well. At the door of the stable, Matthew swung from the saddle, supporting the bulk of his weight with his right arm, until his feet settled on solid ground. A mere stone's throw away sat the little log house that he had built for Livy. He didn't allow his gaze to wander in that direction. He hadn't walked over there yet, because he dreaded going through the empty rooms. They would be just as he and his wife had left them on that fateful afternoon, her Bible resting on the nightstand, her Sunday shoes tucked toe first under the bed, her church dress draped over the back of the rocker. He didn't know if he could handle that. He would have too soon, though. A man couldn't hit the trail without a few changes of clothes. He'd give himself a couple more weeks to heal, target practicing the entire while, and then it would be time to head out. His wife had endured a terrible and painful attack, and he had a score to settle with the Sebastian boys. Matthew wouldn't rest until either he was 6 feet under or every last member of that gang was dead. Chapter 1. 3 years later, May 1890. Weak, rain-drenched sunlight filtered through the lace curtains at the window of the Pacific Express passenger train, casting a dappled pattern on the white sheet of stationery that Eden Paxton clutched in her hand. As the luxury car chugged along the track to crest yet another steep grade on its way to Denver, she reread the words written on the paper for at least the 10th time in a week. Assimilating their meaning gave her the same sense of vertigo she often experienced when she looked down from high places. In short, her whole world had been tipped off its axis, all her hopes, dreams, and plans drifting away from her like pollen in a high wind. Her fiancé, John Parrish, had ended their engagement, not because he no longer loved her, but because his highfalutin parents, San Franciscans of considerable social prominence, disapproved of Eden's lineage. According to them, she lacked a purebred pedigree, and therefore was unsuitable to be John's wife or the mother of his children. John hadn't even had the courage to tell Eden in person, but instead had sent her this dreadful letter. 5 years of my life, she thought bitterly, wasted on a pampered milksop who lacks the backbone to defy his father and mother. Even more telling to Eden, John had failed to stop his parents from vilifying her reputation in order to gain public support for him. It was unseemly for a man to end his engagement to a respectable young lady without just cause. So the Parrish family had whispered the ugly truth about Eden's illegitimate birth to anyone who would listen, not caring a whit about the embarrassment they might cause Eden or her mother Dory. Every time Eden thought about it, she burned with anger. Yesterday morning, she and her mother had left the city in disgrace, scorned by lifelong friends, snubbed in places of business, and turned away from houses they'd visited for years. They were now pariahs in San Francisco, a place they had both considered home. The humiliation had been complete and as sharp as a stiletto. How could John have allowed his parents to behave so shabbily? Eden didn't care so much about the consequences for herself. All the fussiness of city life had set her teeth on edge at times, and she'd grown impatient more than once with her flibbertigibbet friends who cared more about their appearance than anything else. But it had broken Eden's heart to see her mother mistreated. A stiff-necked butler at the home of one prominent family had glared down his nose at Dory Paxton as if she were a cockroach and ordered her off his employer's porch. Dory had handled this dismissal like a grand lady, holding her head high as she quit the property. But Eden would never forget the pain she'd glimpsed in her mother's eyes. As if guessing her daughter's thoughts, Dory curled slender fingers over Eden's wrist, forcing her hand and the letter to her lap. Please, darling, no more fretting on my account. A delicate blonde with gentle blue eyes, Dory flashed an overbright smile. I've wanted to live closer to your brothers for years. Truly, I have. Every time we visited them at one of their ranches, My heart has broken a little when it came time to leave. I thought about relocating. The only reason I never acted on it was because I couldn't bear the thought of leaving you behind. You were so in love with John. Your future seemed to be all mapped out. I couldn't be in two places at once, so I decided to stay put. Eden no longer felt certain that she had ever truly loved John. She'd shed a few tears after receiving his letter, but then anger had taken over. Where was the heartbreak that she should be feeling? Why wasn't she devastated and filled with despair? When a woman truly loved a man, she surely felt something besides outrage and secret relief when he walked away. The thought troubled Eden. How could she have misread her own feelings so completely? Even more worrisome, why had she never seen how weak and spineless John was when it came to displeasing his parents? She considered herself to be a fair judge of character. With four older brothers to educate her, she'd learned at an early age that not all men could be trusted. And yet, she'd trusted John, accepting all his flimsy excuses for postponing their nuptials, never once suspecting that he no longer wanted to marry her. Perhaps that was why she felt only anger, because he'd made a complete fool of her. If Eden possessed one trait in goodly measure, it was pride. Being made to look ridiculous didn't sit well with her. "Everything will work out fine," Dory went on. "You'll see. Remember how wonderful it was when we lived on the ranch in California before Ace started winning big at cards? Despite the struggles, we pulled together after Joseph Sr. died, and we all became so close, a real family." Privately, Eden couldn't help but think the term ranch was a little too grandiose for the scraggly patch of land and three-room shack that they'd been forced to call home when they finally reached California. But her mother was right otherwise. As a family, they had made many wonderful memories during those lean, trying years. Target practicing, going on hunting trips for meat, playing games in the yard after the day's work was completed, and then gathering for evening meals, grateful to have food no matter how simple the fare. Later, when Ace began winning at cards, their circumstances had drastically improved. A rags-to-riches story. But when Eden revisited some of her fondest childhood memories, she often recalled the shack and the wondrous love that had warmed every drafty room. Sticking to her subject, Dory chatted away. "Ace has made some very sound investments on my behalf over the years, you know. Soon I'll have the proceeds from the sale of the house in San Francisco. There will be plenty of capital to start over fresh. No Name is such a friendly little town. I'm sure we're both going to love it there." Eden hoped that would be the case, but deep down she doubted it. For one, her mother was accustomed and well-suited to living in a city where she could enjoy art museums, a well-stocked public library, shopping opportunities galore, and a variety of social activities. No Name, Colorado offered few of those amenities. There was also the fear that Eden's remarkable resemblance to her sister-in-law, Caitlin, would raise suspicion. People in No Name might snub Dory once they realized the truth about her past. But their town drunk, Connor O'Shaughnessy, Caitlin's father and now deceased, had taken wrongful advantage of Dory 24 years ago and left her pregnant with Eden, his bastard daughter. The fine citizens of No Name might not dress as richly as Dory's faithless friends in San Francisco, but under the homespun, they could be just as self-righteous and narrow-minded. None of them would want to associate with Eden or with the woman who had given birth to her. Keeping her thoughts about that to herself, Eden stuffed John's letter back into her beaded reticule and snapped the bag closed. Over the last week, Dory had endured insult after insult, and Eden didn't have the heart to deal her yet another blow by playing devil's advocate. Besides, maybe Eden was wrong, and the good people of No Name would welcome them into their midst with open arms. If not, Eden would deal with the problem when it arose. For now, it felt good to see her mother smiling again. "I love being able to see my brothers on a daily basis," Eden said with forced cheerfulness. "Little Ace is over 2 years old now. Can you believe it? I'll bet he's absolutely darling." "About the age of our little tow-headed traveling companion," Dory replied. At mention of the child seated behind them, Eden glanced over her shoulder to smile at his mother. The slender brunette had done a remarkable job of keeping the toddler entertained during the journey from San Francisco, reading him stories, playing games with him, and helping him to draw pictures. Occasionally, though, the little fellow escaped into the aisle and raced madly back and forth to burn off excess energy. Whenever he stopped near Dory's seat, the older woman plucked interesting objects from her reticule and allowed him to handle them. He was particularly fond of her little mirror and heavily laden ring of house keys. Returning her attention to her mother, Eden said, "As much as I've missed my brothers, I'm excited about seeing the little ones. I have a niece I've never clapped eyes on. In Ace's last letter, he said she's already smiling and trying to make sounds. It'll be so much fun to play with her." Born in December, Dory Sue Keegan was the newest addition to Ace's growing family. Eden didn't approve of parents naming children after living family members. To her way of thinking, the practice created unnecessary confusion for the children. But she was pleased that it made her mother happy to have the baby named after her. "If she's as beautiful as Ace claims, she'll be a delight to behold. Do you suppose her eyes may change from blue to brown when she gets older?" Dory nodded. "It's possible, but I'm hoping not. With Caitlin's fair complexion and Ace's black hair, she'll be truly breathtaking if her eyes remain blue." Dory studied Eden's face, a slight frown furrowing her brow. "If the baby resembles Caitlin as much as Ace says she does, she also looks exactly like you. How are you going to feel about that? The first time you met Caitlin, I know it gave you a start." Meeting Ace's wife the first time had given Eden far more than a start. It had been like seeing her own reflection in a mirror, and had shocked her to the marrow of her bones. Caitlin was a bit shorter than Eden, but otherwise they looked enough alike to be twins, sharing the same fine features, wide blue eyes, and flame-red hair. Until meeting Caitlin, Eden had accepted on a superficial level that Connor O'Shaughnessy was her biological father, but the reality of it had never been driven home until she stood face-to-face with her sister-in-law and saw the undeniable evidence of her parentage with her very own eyes. "I'll be fine, Mama. I've come to love Caitlin. You know that. She isn't to blame for what our father did." Eden patted her mother's hand to reassure her. Immediately after being told the truth about her real father, Eden had been furious with Dory for lying to her for so many years. But, over time, she'd come to understand that her mother had meant well. Bastards weren't welcomed into polite society, and Dory's deception had spared Eden untold heartbreak during her childhood. If people in San Francisco had known of Eden's illegitimacy and that her father was a land swindler and murderer, they would have made her life a living hell. "I'll enjoy having a little niece who looks like me." Settling back in the plush leather seat, Eden turned her mind to other possible topics of conversation. Revisiting the past always upset Dory, and little wonder. The poor woman had lived through trials that many females wouldn't have survived. "I'm feeling a bit parched. I wonder if they have any lemonade on board." Dory glanced at the gold watch pinned to her pleated silk bodice. "It's nearly midday. We could adjourn to the dining car a little early. I'm hungry already." "That is a grand idea." Eden reached up to straighten her hat, an awkward creation bedecked with a riotous fan of red feathers and a fake canary. One nice thing about moving to No Name was that she would no longer have to follow fashions she felt were absurd. Her brothers would have a good laugh when they saw her with a bird perched on her head and wouldn't hesitate to poke fun at her high-necked choker collar and bell-shaped skirt. Pushing to her feet, she offered her mother a hand up. "If we're early, we can have our choice of tables. And perhaps we can save a place for that young woman with the tow-headed little boy," Dory suggested. "He is such a sweet child." Eden glanced over her shoulder to smile at the young mother again. The toddler was squirming in his seat and rubbing his eyes with one plump fist. Eden sympathized. The train ride from San Francisco to Denver was always fun and exciting at the start, but the novelty soon wore off, even for adults. "Would you and your little boy care to join us for dinner?" she asked the brunette. "My name is Eden, Eden Paxton. My mother's name is Dory. We'd greatly enjoy the company." Helen Roderick, the brunette said, leaning forward on the seat to briefly clasp Eden's outstretched hand. And we'd love to join you. Thank you so much for the invitation. Eden chucked the little boy under his chin. And what is your name, young man? The child muttered something indecipherable. Helen clarified with, Timothy. Hello, Timothy. I'm delighted to meet you. To Helen, Eden added, Perhaps over lunch we can keep him entertained so you can enjoy your meal for a change. Helen laughed and flashed a grateful smile. That would be fabulous. He's getting very restless, and I'm running out of ideas to keep him distracted. I'm getting restless, too, Eden sympathized. According to the Little Giant Cyclopedia of Ready Reference, modern-day trains travel at an average speed of just a little over 48 miles an hour, but this one definitely isn't. The brunette laughed again as she set Timothy off her lap and vacated her seat. If only we were traveling that fast, we would have reached Denver sometime early this morning. Instead, we won't be arriving until late tonight. Eden smoothed her silk skirt. My traveling costume will be hopelessly stale and wrinkled when we finally reach our destination. After we get to Denver, we have to take another train south from there to No Name. It's all these steep grades, Dory inserted. No train on Earth can consistently travel at 48 miles per hour up all these inclines. Just as Eden turned to collect her reticule, the passenger car lurched violently. The sound of tearing metal filled her ears as she was thrown against the back of the seat in front of her. The impact snapped her forward at the waist, and she barely managed to catch herself from becoming airborne. Her blasted hat, securely anchored to her head with pins, went flying, taking some of her hair with it. Concerned for her mother, Eden groped for Dory's elbow. Timothy, are you all right? Helen cried from behind them. Did you bump your head? Dear God! A man somewhere at the back of the car shouted. We must have hit another train. Or there's some sort of debris on the tracks. Another man grumped. I swear, as much as I've paid for my fare, you'd think I'd get better service. Mother, are you hurt? Eden asked, helping Dory to regain her balance. Dory collected herself with brisk efficiency, righting her plumed hat and tugging on the cuffs of her leg-a-mutton sleeves to straighten her velvet traveling jacket. My goodness, what a fright! I'm fine, dear, just fine. Dory cast a worried glance at the crying toddler behind them. Is little Timothy okay? Bent over her son, Helen replied, He's got a goose egg on his forehead, but I don't think any serious damage was done. I wonder what on earth we hit, Dory mused aloud. Eden was about to reply when a distant popping sound came from outside the train. Oh, sweet Jesus, have mercy, a woman across the aisle bleated. It's a holdup. We'll all be killed. Helen grabbed her tow-headed son into her arms. Perhaps it's only a mechanical malfunction. Eden had been around weapons too often to believe that. The muted popping sounds were gunfire, no question about it. The train was about to be robbed. Eden quickly switched places with her mother. What are you doing? Dory cried. Eden knew better than to confess that she wanted to be in the aisle seat in case the situation became violent. Dory was older and frailer. Eden would recover from a physical injury far more quickly. I just want to see what's happening. As she spoke, Eden sat down, spread a lace handkerchief over her lap, and began unfastening the diamond pin from her bodice. Remove your jewelry, Mama. If it's a robbery, they'll want all our valuables. If we cooperate, we should be fine. Dory clucked her tongue. Not my wedding band, surely. It's not worth much, and it has a great deal of sentimental value to me. Tuck it inside your bodice and give me everything else, then. Eden replied. In a louder voice, she addressed the other passengers. If you want to survive this spot of trouble without any mishap, bundle all your jewelry and money in a handkerchief and stand ready to hand it over without argument. Oh, dear God, a woman cried. Another woman snorted in disdain. I refuse to hand over my ruby bracelet. It cost a fortune. Is it more important to you than your life? Eden dropped her timepiece and gold locket onto the handkerchief. Then she reached into her reticule for her engagement ring, which she'd stopped wearing after receiving John's letter. The large emerald, encircled by diamonds, was ostentatious and had never been to her liking. But John had selected it, and she'd always worn it with pride. It was one piece of frippery she would never miss. "Hurry, Mama!" Eden heard footsteps on the platform at the front of the car and the faint sound of screams coming from the car behind them where other passengers, with less coin, were packed together in more Spartan accommodations. "We must be ready to hand it all over," Eden pressed. "That's why they're here, for our valuables and any gold or cash that may be on board. If we draw no attention to ourselves, perhaps they'll pass us by without a second look." The door burst open, and three disreputable-looking men spilled into the car, all of them wielding Colt 45 revolvers, Eden's own sidearm of choice. As a youngster, she'd spent countless hours learning to handle all types of weapons, a skill her eldest brother, Ace, had deemed highly important, even for a girl. But young ladies in the upper echelons of San Francisco society had no need to carry a gun. Though Eden still target practiced on a regular basis to avoid getting rusty, she'd fallen out of the habit of keeping a weapon on her person. Eden took the measure of the robbers and was instantly filled with dread. They were the filthiest creatures she'd ever seen, their clothing rank, their unshaven faces gray with grime. But what truly alarmed her were their eyes. Her brother Joseph had taught her to size a man up by searching his gaze. "Eyes are windows to the soul," he was fond of saying. "Look hard and look deep, little sister. If you can't see into a man, run like hell." These men's eyes resembled gray marbles, cold, glassy, and expressionless. The hair at the nape of Eden's neck prickled. Unfortunately, running like hell wasn't an option. She could only send up a quick prayer that no one on board would be harmed. The men seemed well-practiced in the art of robbery. One rushed to the back of the car, a second covered the middle, and the third took a stand near the front door, brandishing his weapon as he thrust out a soiled drawstring bag to collect the passengers' valuables. "Jewelry, timepieces, money," he barked. "Keep your traps shut and hand it all over if you want to stay alive." The finely dressed gentleman at the front of the car pushed up from his seat. "Here now, there's no need for violence," he cried. That was all the poor man had time to say before he was shot dead center in the chest. The bullet's impact sent him careening backward onto his wife's lap. The woman began to shriek hysterically, pressing her hands over the hole in her husband's shirt, which oozed blood. "Morrison!" she cried. "Morrison!" She looked up at the robber, slack-jawed with shock. "You've killed him!" she screamed. "You've killed him dead!" The bandit leveled his gun at the woman's forehead. "And I'll kill you dead if you don't shut up." He tore a necklace from around her throat and stuffed it in the bag. "Give me the rings, now, or I'll hack off your fingers to get them. Don't think I won't." The woman tugged at her blood-smeared rings, trying to pull them over badly swollen, arthritic knuckles. "Morrison, Morrison," she chanted softly. "Oh, dear God, dear God." Eden sat frozen in her seat. She'd never seen anyone die. Ace and Joseph had always tried to shield her from the ugly aspects of life, and they'd been mostly successful. For a seemingly endless second, she could only stare in horrified disbelief at the murdered man's sprawled legs. How could a life end so quickly? The tow-headed child behind them began to cry again. Eden heard Helen frantically trying to shush him. The bandit who manned the middle of the car waved his gun in a threatening manner. "Jewels and money, and be fast about it if you don't want no holes in your hide." He extended a bag toward an older woman two rows forward. "I said everything," he barked when the matronly lady failed to hand over her earrings. Then, without waiting for her to comply, he jerked the gold loops from her ears, tearing the flesh of her lobes in the process. "Your fault, not mine. Stay quiet, hand stuff over, and there'll be no trouble." The woman's husband surged to his feet. "Dad, blast you to kingdom come, you miserable excuse for..." The robber fired his Colt, burying a bullet right between the poor man's eyes. And just that quickly, another person was dead. Eden was now trembling violently, one litany repeating in her mind, "God help us, God help us, God help us." To her horror, the robber's attention shifted to the shrieking child behind her. "Timothy!" Eden's heart caught. She heard Helen's breath snag in terror.
Shut that little shit up, the gunman snarled, or I'll plug him too. Glancing back over her shoulder, Eden recognized Helen's paralyzing fear because she felt it herself. Instead of soothing the little boy, Helen clutched him rigidly to her bosom, her eyes as large as nickels, the pupils dilated with terror. Frightened by his mother's stiffness, the child screamed more loudly. The bandit stomped closer, raising his Colt as if to shoot. I told you to shut him up! Helen began petting the boy, the flutter of her trembling hands frantic, her softly uttered reassurances unconvincing. The child shrank closer to her torso and let loose with an ear-piercing wail. The robber stopped and took deadly aim at the back of the toddler's head. Eden sprang up from her seat, spun, and threw herself over Helen and the boy. No! She cried. He's only a baby! Spreading her arms and legs to provide the mother and child with more cover, Eden heard heavy footfalls advancing on her. Please, no, don't hurt him. We'll make him be quiet. We will. Just give us a moment. The next instant, Eden's scalp exploded with pain as the gunman's hand closed over her chignon and jerked her erect. She stumbled and nearly fell backward into him. As terrified as she was, she shuddered at the stench of his unwashed body, a nostril-burning blend of urine, soured sweat, and whiskey. The force of his grip on her hair inflicted such pain that she turned to relieve the sting and found herself looking up into his unshaven countenance and hard gray eyes. Well now, he sneered, running his gaze from her face downward to take measure of her person. Ain't you a pretty little thing? Be nice to me, and maybe I won't kill the squalling little snot. Bile surged up the back of Eden's throat. This animal had just killed two men. She wanted to spit in his face, but fear tempered the urge. As if he guessed her thoughts, he twisted his fist in her hair and rammed the barrel of the Colt against her cheekbone. Eden braced herself, convinced that he meant to pull the trigger. In some distant part of her mind, she registered that the little boy had stopped screaming, and thanked God that his mother had managed to silence him.
Don't hurt her,
Dory pleaded, her words interspersed with sobs. Please, mister, don't hurt her. She's done nothing to you, nothing. Just take the valuables and leave her be. Please. Eden straightened her shoulders and met the man's gaze. She saw no mercy in those stone-gray depths, and in that moment she knew she was going to die. Fear made her legs quiver, and she almost wet herself. She wished her mother would be quiet. This man would kill Dory with no more regret than he would feel swatting an insect.
Don't hurt her!
Dory cried again. Another gunshot rang out at the back of the train. Eden flinched. Some poor woman's wails told Eden that someone else had just taken a bullet. Afraid her mother might be next, Eden cried, Our valuables are on the floor. They're worth a small fortune. Take them and go. Tightening his meaty hand over Eden's hair, the bandit bent his head and slurped his tongue over her lips. Only by sheer force of will was she able to keep herself from gagging. His front teeth had rotted into little brown snags. His spit tasted like vinegar. When he straightened, his battered gray hat sat askew, revealing greasy brown hair gone pewter gray at the temples. You're more valuable than a handful of trinkets, he informed her with a leer. Across the border, a little redhead like you will bring top dollar. The man at the rear of the car yelled, We gonna keep her, Wallace? Hot damn, we'll have a fine time tonight. Oh, how Eden wished for a gun. Ace had taught her well. With her Colt at her hips, she could have taken on all three men and been the only shooter left standing when the smoke cleared. Instead, she could only remain there with her neck twisted to ease the pain of the brutal grip on her hair. Why not? Her assailant replied with a laugh. If nothing else, she'll give us some fun. Before Eden could react, the man bent at the knees, tossed her over his shoulder, and started back up the aisle. Collect the rest of the loot, he barked. We need to make tracks. Grabbing for breath, Eden made fists in the tails of the robber's filthy jacket, her head spinning from the rush of blood to her brain. She heard Dory screaming and could only pray one of the bandits didn't silence her with a bullet.
Relief swamped her when no shots rang out. Her rump collided with the door as her captor drew it open. Then the cold May air cut through her clothing, its iciness nipping at her skin. It hit Eden then. These horrible men planned to abduct her. She needed to do something to save herself. Only what? Physically, she was no match for them, and she had no weapon. Her upper body bounced with each fall of her captor's feet as he descended the steps from the platform. Then she heard gravel crunching beneath his boots. Oh, God! Oh, God! If he got her on a horse, her chances to escape would be nil. Frantic, she pummeled his spine with knotted fists. When that didn't slow his pace, she grabbed hold of his jacket and walked her hands up his back until she was nearly upright. Then she went after his head, knocking off his hat as she cracked him in the temple with her elbow. He grunted and staggered. Leave off, bitch! Temper, always the bane of her existence, flared hot. Bitch! Hissing air through clenched teeth, she clawed at his ear and tried with everything she had to bury the sharp toes of her Dongola Kid boots into his groin. He roared with rage, grabbed her arm, and threw her to the ground. Eden rolled and scrambled to her feet, but before she could run, he was upon her. She nailed him square on the eye socket with her right fist and was about to slug him again when he retaliated in kind, his bunched knuckles coming at her so fast that they connected with her jaw before she could duck. Black spots danced before Eden's eyes. She blinked and staggered, determined to remain on her feet. But her knees turned to water and down she went. The world had gone strangely gray, a swirling eddy of earth, trees, and sky that sucked her into a black vortex. Chapter 2. The unmistakable smell of blood wafted to Matthew Coulter's nostrils on the cold, rain-washed morning air. Faintly sweet, with a metallic bite, the scent rolled over the back of his tongue, putting him in mind of how water from his canteen tasted after he'd been 2 days on the trail without coming across a stream. He drew his horse, Smokey, to a stop so suddenly that the pack mule behind them bumped into the gelding's rump. The Sebastians. Everywhere those bastards went, they left a trail of blood. Matthew had no idea whom they'd killed this time, only that the remains lay somewhere nearby. Oh, yes. He knew without a doubt that the Sebastians were responsible. He'd been hot on their trail for several days, and the tracks had led him directly here. No mistake, no maybe to it. Wallace Sebastian rode a horse with a paddle gait that left a track as unique as a man's fingerprint. Matthew would have recognized that odd stride pattern anywhere. Shifting in the saddle, he reached back to unfasten the strap that held his Winchester and the sheepskin rifle boot. At close range, he normally preferred to use his revolvers. But in rabbit brush thicker than fleas on a hound's back and billowing 4 feet tall, he'd be a damn fool to take on 5 fast guns with his Colts. Dancing and rolling to avoid a slug would be nigh onto impossible with his feet tangled in undergrowth. He'd be wiser to hit the dirt, burrow deep in the foliage, and pick off the brutes with his long barrel. Smokey snorted, clearly unnerved. Matthew stroked the gray's neck and then nudged him back into a walk. The poor horse had to plow forward through the bushes, every step impeded by the thick snarl of branches. Herman, the mule, balked and let loose with one of his odd-sounding whinnies, a cross between a bray and a neigh. Damn it. There went any chance Matthew may have had to catch the gang by surprise. Not that he blamed the mule. Even the dumbest animals on earth recognized the smell of fresh blood. And Herman sensed the danger. All his instincts were probably telling him to turn tail and run. Grabbing hold of the lead rope, Matthew gave a sharp tug to get the pack animal moving again. As both beasts pressed forward, Matthew made a mental note to slap them on the rump if trouble started. Over the last 3 years, Smokey and Herman had become Matthew's only friends. He didn't want either of them to take a bullet. Moments later, they broke into a small clearing surrounded by stands of stunted oak and various bushes heavy with blossoms of pink, yellow, purplish-blue, and white that stood out against the gray-green backdrop of brush. What appeared to be a peddler's wagon was parked to one side of the opening, its garishly painted doors yawning to reveal a gutted interior. The team that had pulled the wagon to this spot was nowhere in sight, the poles and traces lying empty. Pots, pans, shoes, clothing, books, farm implements, and other wares had been scattered every which way across the rain-soaked ground. An old man in a brown suit lay sprawled amid the rubble. Even at a distance, Matthew could see that he was beyond help. The poor fellow's throat had been slit, an Arkansas grin curving from one ear to the other under his bewhiskered chin. Matthew's skin turned as pebbly as a fresh-plucked chicken's. In the sunlight that had just broken through the clouds, the blood on the peddler's neck glistened wet and bright red. He had been dead for only a few minutes. His killers couldn't be very far away. Jerking the lead rope loose from his saddle to set the mule free, Matthew fanned the chambers of his colt to make certain they were fully loaded, a purely reflexive gesture because he always kept the chambers full, and then reined his horse in a circle to scan the surrounding brush. In land like this, the horned larks and prairie chickens normally chirped and flitted in the bushes, and small rodents scampered every which way. Not so in this place. A spooky hush lay over everything. The breeze had suddenly abated. Not even a leaf moved in the clumps of gnarly oak. Withers twitching, ears cocked forward, Smokey blew and sidestepped, his shod hooves sharply striking a partially buried slab of shale. The tattoo rang out in the hush like rifle shots. Matthew had a bad case of the whim-whams himself. Before dismounting, he rode a wide loop around the clearing to make sure the gang had left. He soon found churned earth, an indication that the fiends had lit out in a northwesterly direction. After studying the tracks, Matthew determined that they'd taken the peddler's two-horse wagon team with them, draft animals, judging by the size of the hoofprints. Matthew burned to go after them. He'd gotten this close to one of them only once before, a memorable afternoon down Tucson Way when he belly-crawled through cactuses pricklier than whores on Sunday to sight in his Winchester on the youngest Sebastian brother, who'd been dispatched to the nearest town to replenish the gang's liquor supply. Sadly for Eric Sebastian, the call of the alcohol had been more urgent to him than getting back to his siblings, so he'd stopped off under a mesquite tree to have a few snorts. With no regrets, Matthew had emerged from the cactuses, poised himself to draw, and, after telling the other man why he was there, had sent him off to meet his maker, making the world a safer place and reducing the infamous Sebastian gang's number to 5. Since then, though, it had been slim pickings, with Matthew hearing of a horrendous crime and herring off after the wrong desperados. Or, even more frustrating, joining up with yet another posse composed of an incompetent lawman and a ragtag collection of clodbusters who started out strong but lacked the stick-to-itiveness necessary to stay on the Sebastian's trail. In a way, Matthew had understood their lackadaisical attitudes. A man had to lose someone precious and dear. He had to hate and lust for revenge in order to stay with a chore that seemed endless, paid nothing, and offered few creature comforts. Now, after so many false leads and bitter tastes of defeat, Matthew was once again right on the Sebastian's asses. He swore he could smell the stench of their unwashed bodies lingering in the air. Unfortunately, before he gave chase, he needed to properly bury the old man. As hardened as Matthew had grown since departing from Oregon, he still clung to the tenets of common decency that his father and mother had drilled into him. Leaving a dead body out in the open to become carrion for vultures and predators wasn't in his makeup. He'd even buried Eric Sebastian, the devil take his rotten soul, rather than abandon the bastard in the desert to become crow bait. Once back in the clearing, Matthew set to work with a small spade he carried in his pack. The tediousness of the grim task left him with too much time to think. Death. It had a way of creeping up on a person without warning. It troubled him how quickly a life could end. The rocky ground made for difficult digging. Fortunately, Matthew was able to go shallow and cover the body with the stones he unearthed. Even so, the sun had nearly reached its zenith by the time he finished the excavation. He closed the peddler's eyes and tugged off the old man's jacket to cover his bloodless face before lowering him into the shallow grave. "Jesus, help me," he prayed as he covered the remains with rock. Since setting out after the Sebastians, he'd seen sights that would haunt his dreams for the rest of his days. This morning, the Sebastian's victim was an elderly man whose life had been nearly over, but that wasn't always the case. Those heartless polecats killed young and old alike. Only a few months ago, Matthew had come across a Spanish family down in Mexico, mother, father, four older children, and a brand new baby, who had been slaughtered like pigs. Judging by the condition of the woman's body, she'd been repeatedly raped before being sent off to meet her maker. The memory still made Matthew shake with horror or rage, probably both. Their deaths had been so pointless. But the Sebastians had slain them nevertheless, and with no more regret than Matthew felt over shooting a rabbit for the roasting spit. Bastards. They were worse than animals. Removing his Stetson, Matthew stood beside the old man's grave. Another heavy rain would pack down the freshly turned earth. In only a short while, the peddler's final resting place would look like nothing more than a rock heap. Passers-by wouldn't even realize someone was buried here. The thought sent Matthew back to the perimeters of the clearing with his hatchet. He worked up a sweat cutting two lengths of green wood to form a cross, which he bound together with rawhide thongs. Then he spent a good half hour carving "A Peddler Killed by the Sebastian Gang" into the crossbar. As he drove the marker deep into the dirt at the head of the grave, he could at least console himself with the certainty that the old fellow's resting place would be recognized as such for a couple of years. Afterward, Matthew mounted his horse, collected his mule, and went to find the tracks he'd seen earlier. His blood surged with excitement, which he quickly tamped down. The brothers had cut a broad swath through the brush, the trail so clear that a child could have followed it. Matthew was going to catch up with them this time. He felt it in his bones. Time to ride. If he'd learned anything over the last 3 years, it was that the Sebastians had a talent for vanishing into thin air. Matthew wasn't about to let them slip away from him again. No how, no way. Not this time. He would make up for the delay and catch up with them again or die trying. Scanning the horizon every few seconds, he followed the tracks. The Sebastians were shrewd. If they suspected someone was on their heels, they'd double back to pick him off. Matthew flexed his shoulders and released a taut breath. Letting down one's guard was a greenhorn's mistake, and he was no greenhorn, not anymore. Being on the trail had taught him a host of lessons, the most important being that it wasn't always speed with a gun that saved a man's life. Sometimes it was pure old-fashioned common sense and having eyes in the back of his head. Determined to stay alert, Matthew settled into the saddle for the long ride that lay ahead. At the start of this mission, he had always been in a hurry, a feverish eagerness burning in his veins, even as he slept. But he'd soon realized that only dogged determination would enable him to succeed where so many posses had failed. It was a lonely and often boring endeavor. Except for changes in the weather and coming upon dead bodies more often than he liked, one day was pretty much like the next, a monotonous repetition of riding mile after mile, followed by sleeping along the trail with only his saddle as a pillow and his animals for company. His rare brushes with civilization occurred only when he fell in with a posse, needed supplies, or went digging for information about where the Sebastian gang had last been seen. He seldom met anyone intriguing during those brief sojourns in a town. Shopkeepers, sporting women, and drifters. After a while, their faces all looked the same, and their stories all sounded alike. In the beginning, Matthew had kept a journal, but after a time he'd given up on that. His Gaelic-speaking mother, born in the old country, had studied relentlessly to attain a good command of English, and insisted that her children do the same. Though Matthew had only 5 years of formal schooling, he developed a good vocabulary and spelling skills, but he still wasn't a great hand at writing. He penned his thoughts pretty much like he talked, simple and to the point. When he wrote home to let his folks know he was still alive, he kept it short. "Hello, I'm fine. Hope you are too." He had no way of knowing if his letters reached their destination, because he never stayed in one place long enough to get return mail. Hell, so far as he knew, both his parents could be dead by now. The thought saddened Matthew, but not in the sharp, painful way it once would have. He had trouble remembering his loved ones' faces when he thought of them now, and homesickness had lost its hold on him long ago. The ranch had become a distant memory, the squat little cabin he'd shared with Olivia a blur. Sometimes he almost forgot why he'd undertaken this task. Then a nightmare about Livy's death would jerk him awake from a sound sleep, and he'd remember with harsh clarity. Bottom line was, he'd set himself a goal, and he couldn't give up until every last one of the Sebastians was dead. He'd failed to protect his wife, and punishing her killers was the only way he knew to make up for that. Once he avenged Livy's death, he had no idea what the future might hold for him. Oregon no longer called his name. Too many bad memories waited for him there. Maybe he'd hire on somewhere as a cowhand or bronco buster, saving his wages until he had a stake and could start his own ranch. Montana still had a lot of wide-open country. A man could make a fresh start there and put the past behind him. It'd be lonely, but Matthew had come to accept that as his lot in life. He didn't have what it took to be a decent husband, or father, for that matter. A man worth his salt protected his family. Guiding his horse through a dense thicket of skunk brush and mountain mahogany, Matthew followed the Sebastian's tracks to a promontory where thickets of silver buffalo berry clumped around huge boulders. After picking his way through the dense foliage and rocks, he reined in sharply and stood in the stirrups to see over the edge of the cliff, wondering what the gang members had been thinking to take their horses down such steep, treacherous terrain. In the draw below, he saw only brush at first, but then his gaze caught on a glint of steel. Railroad tracks. Following their course, he saw a train in the distance. The locomotive appeared to have jumped the tracks. Matthew couldn't determine what might have caused that, but he had a bad feeling it hadn't been an accident. Squinting to see, he counted 5 cars between the locomotive and caboose, and they didn't look to be the kind that carried freight. Too fancy. A passenger train, maybe? His chest went tight with dread. Now he understood why the Sebastians had put their horses at risk to go down the steep slope. They'd waited up here to ambush the train. Lips pressed into a tight line, Matthew turned east, hoping to find a safer way down into the draw. To his surprise, he discovered that the Sebastians had ridden this way as well. Their tracks soon led to a gentler slope that looked less dangerous for Matthew's animals. As he began the descent, he realized why the gang had chosen not to launch its attack from this angle. The people on the train would have seen them coming, just as they could see Matthew now. 2 men emerged from the locomotive onto its rear platform. They seemed to be looking at Matthew through binoculars. One of them held a rifle at the ready in the crook of his arm. As Matthew drew closer, he saw piles of broken rock scattered across the tracks in front of the derailed locomotive. Mystery solved. To stop the train, the Sebastians had rolled some boulders into its path. Then they'd ridden back to the promontory to await the inevitable collision. Bastards. Matthew hoped the man with the gun didn't get nervous and shoot. If the train had recently been robbed, as Matthew suspected, tension would be high, and the approach of a stranger might make the rifleman edgy. He wore a brown plaid frock suit and a jaunty bowler hat, pegging him as a passenger and possibly a city fellow. Wasn't that just perfect? Matthew had never met a dandy yet who knew squat about firearms. The other man, a bull-necked, portly gent, wore a black suit and matching billed cap. Though Matthew had never traveled on a passenger train, he figured the fellow to be the conductor or some other kind of railway employee. He lifted a hand and waved, hoping to let them know he was friendly. Being mistaken for a bandit wouldn't make for a pleasant encounter. Howdy, he called out as he drew closer. The man in black placed his hands on the platform railing and leaned forward at the waist. What brings you here, mister? Some 20 feet from them, Matthew reined in his horse. The pack mule let loose with a nervous bray whinnying. I'm after the Sebastian gang. Their tracks led me here. You a bounty hunter? No, sir. Well, you sure don't have the look of a lawman. Matthew fingered the thick growth of whiskers on his jaw. Stopping to wash and shave isn't easy when you're trying to run polecats to ground. Name's Matthew Coulter. Hail from Oregon. You're a long way from home, partner.
Matthew nudged up the brim of his hat to meet the men's gazes. That I am. He cast a glance at the rock-strewn tracks. Looks to me like you're in a fine fix. Yes, we are. The dandy in the frock coat lowered the rifle to his side, a gesture that indicated he no longer felt threatened. Problem was that the barrel of the weapon was now pointed straight at Matthew. We've got three dead, and they took a young woman hostage. The chill moved down Matthew's spine. If the Sebastians had taken a woman, she'd most likely be dead by sundown. If not, she'd be wishing she were. I'm sorry to hear that. The Sebastians aren't exactly what you'd call gentle with the ladies. He inclined his head at the rifle. If it's all the same to you, my friend, I'd feel easier if you pointed that gun at something besides me. The fellow quickly shifted the rifle so the shooting end was aimed at the sky. Were any passengers hurt in the wreck? Matthew asked. Mostly cuts and bruises, but one man went flying and busted some ribs. He's been spitting blood and should see a doctor. Help is probably on the way, Matthew replied. The telegrapher at the next station would have sounded an alarm the moment he realized the train was overdue. Not at Holden Creek, the conductor countered. The telegrapher there up and died a few weeks back. Matthew shifted in the saddle. So who took his place? Nobody yet. The conductor fingered open his watch pocket. After Holden Creek, it's almost 5 hours to the next stop. He checked the time. By my calculations, no alarm will be raised for another 3 hours. Matthew absorbed that bit of news. One of you needs to go for help, then. They've surely got a sawbones in Holden Creek. That man spitting blood could have a punctured lung. The city fellow gestured at the broken boulders. The train is dead in its tracks, and we have no horse. Matthew almost asked if they'd ever heard of walking. The injured man could die without medical treatment. Damn, wasn't this just his luck? He knew, without their even asking, that they expected him to head toward Holden Creek. If he allowed himself to get sidetracked that way, the Sebastians would get miles ahead of him, and he'd play hell catching up with them again. He rubbed his jaw, wishing he had it in him to just ride away. How far is it to Holden Creek? He finally asked. 10, maybe 11 miles. That's a long way for a man to walk when he's not dressed for this cold weather and the freezing rain. The conductor eyed Matthew's buckskin jacket, which had turned supple and shiny from repeated applications of bear grease to make it shed water. You reckon you could get word to the marshal there that we need assistance and a doctor? The way Matthew saw it, the rain had let up, and the sun was out. 10 miles wasn't that far for a man to walk. He had hoofed it that far a number of times. Maybe they were afraid to leave the relative safety of the train. The Sebastian boys had a talent for putting the fear of God into folks. With an inward sigh, Matthew went over his options, hating to waste precious time on an unnecessary side trip. But in the end, he couldn't see that he had a choice. There was the injured man to think about. How much blood is that man spitting up? Matthew asked. Not much, just a little pink now and again. The conductor arched an eyebrow. Why do you ask? I hate to press my animals unless it's a matter of life and death. They've come a far piece. We won't quarrel with how fast you ride, Coulter, just so long as you go. I think the injured man will be okay until help arrives. My horse and mule can go about 4 miles an hour at a steady walk. At that rate, it'll take me 2.5 hours to reach Holden Creek, plus a few minutes to talk with the marshal. With fresh horses, he and his men should be able to make it back here in a little over an hour if they ride fairly hard. That puts help about 4 hours out. Do you think the injured fellow can hold on that long? We have him bedded down. If he doesn't move and do more damage, he should make it. Just then, a petite older woman came tearing down the platform steps of a passenger car. The most outlandish hat Matthew had ever seen was perched at an angle atop her head, silk flowers, gewgaws, and feathers poking every which way. Hands clapped to her waist, she ran toward them, the leg-a-mutton sleeves of her blue velvet traveling costume flapping like the wings of a frantic bird. As she drew up near Smokey's flank, she pushed a strand of graying blonde hair from her eyes. Please, sir, you must ride for help at a fast pace. Those horrible men took my daughter. If someone doesn't catch up with them quickly, they might do her serious harm. Apparently, the lady had heard Matthew say he didn't want to exhaust his animals by pushing them too hard. His mouth went as dry as dirt. He knew the Sebastians would kill this woman's daughter before a posse ever caught up with them. The Sebastian boys wasted no time with their raping and murdering. "I'm about to leave now, ma'am," Matthew said, his voice thick and hoarse. "I'll tell the marshal to get a group of men together as fast as he can." She pressed quivering fingertips to her pale cheeks, her blue eyes swimming with tears as she nodded. Thank you," she murmured. "She's a good, sweet girl who's never harmed a soul. If something happens to her, it'll break my heart." Resigned, Matthew nudged his horse into a trot, a pace he set only for the woman's benefit. Once out of sight, he'd slow Smokey to a walk. There was little point in killing his horse and mule in an attempt to save a girl who probably couldn't be saved. Why was it that every time he almost caught up with those rotten bastards, something went wrong? Holden Creek turned out to be a one-horse town with a train station only a bit larger than a water closet. As predicted by the conductor, the place stood empty. The main street was little more than a rutted dirt path lined with uneven boardwalks, wobbly hitching posts, and straggly clumps of soapweed yucca. The saloon appeared to be the largest establishment, even larger than the church at the far end of town. What a fine testimony that was to humankind. Not that Matthew begrudged anybody a snort. He imbibed a bit himself, but with the church barely bigger than a sitting room and a school not in evidence, he couldn't help but wonder about this community's priorities. The marshal's office was no more impressive than a train station, situated amongst a string of businesses with battered doors and closed signs that hung crooked in every dusty window. Strange. According to Matthew's calculations, it was Thursday. In most towns, the shops closed only on Sundays, and often not even then. Maybe he had his days mixed up. No big surprise if he did. There had been times over the last 3 years when he'd forgotten what month it was, let alone the day of the week. Matthew pulled up in front of the unimpressive law office, dismounted, and tethered his horse to the hitching rail before stepping up onto the weathered wooden walkway. The door proved to be unlocked, creaking open with a light push of Matthew's thumb on the lever. Though a fire crackled in the rust-streaked pot-bellied stove, and a dented blue pot on one of the burner plates emitted the scorched smell of overboiled coffee, the room and single cell at the back were empty. Shit. The last thing Matthew wanted was to waste more time trying to find a lawman. Where the hell was he? Turning and closing the door, Matthew angled a look across the street, settling his gaze on the batwing doors of the saloon. Piano music tinkled from within the establishment, and an occasional burst of laughter trailed to him on the afternoon breeze. It struck Matthew as being mighty early in the day for folks to be imbibing, but who was he to judge? One thing was for sure. There was no better place than a local watering hole to get information. Before striking off across the muddy thoroughfare, Matthew tethered Herman to the hitching post beside Smokey so he could reach the water trough. A little liquid refreshment would do all three of them a world of good. Matthew decided he might even buy himself a jug for the trail. When he killed the Sebastian brothers, there would be cause to celebrate. It'd be a hell of a note if he had no whiskey to mark the moment. The interior of the saloon was undistinguished, a mirror reflection of a thousand others he'd seen over the last 3 years, complete with the requisite oil painting of a nude lady hanging above the bar. Ironically, the saloon's piano key tapper was playing The Fountain in the Park, a romantic ballad with sappy lyrics that Matthew hadn't heard since leaving Oregon. A sporting woman in a faded red dress belted out the words, flinging her arms wide as if she were performing on stage for a huge audience. While strolling in the park one day, in the merry month of May, she smiled and homed in on Matthew, her gaze a bloodshot blue that spoke of too many whiskey-soaked nights. "I was taken by surprise by a roguish pair of eyes. In a moment, my poor heart was stole away." Matthew ignored the invitation,
He couldn't waste time in an upstairs room right now, even if he'd felt so inclined, which he didn't. The woman looked like she'd been ridden hard and put away wet. Matthew had enough troubles without catching the clap. He turned his attention to three older men who sat at a corner table playing poker. "Can one of you tell me where I might find the marshal?" "You found him." The portliest of the three men turned on his chair, the bulge of his belly rubbing the table's edge. "How can I help you?" Matthew's heart sank. The man was old, for starters, and to top it off, he appeared to be more than a little drunk. Pulling out a chair, Matthew turned it around to straddle the seat. After 3 years in the saddle, he no longer felt comfortable sitting the proper way. As quickly as possible, he told the marshal about the train holdup. "The Sebastian gang, you say?" The elderly lawman rubbed his balding pate. "How can you be so all-fired sure it was them?" "Because I've been tracking them for 3 years. Trust me, it was the Sebastians. They're a dangerous bunch by all accounts." More dangerous than this old fellow could imagine. "Yes, sir, they're very dangerous. Luckily for you, they're long gone by now, so you won't have to deal with any of them. Why are you tracking them?" Matthew found it difficult to talk about what had happened to Olivia. "I've got my reasons." "You aren't thinking about taking the law into your own hands, are you, mister?" Matthew ignored the question and pushed to his feet. After glancing at his pocket watch, he snapped the lid closed and said, "If you ride hard, Marshal, you can reach the train in a little over an hour. One of the passengers is in a bad way, so you should take the local Sawbones along if you can." The marshal nodded and swayed to his feet. For an instant, Matthew entertained the notion of telling the lawman about the kidnapped young woman, but he quickly discarded the idea. He didn't want a posse of drunks catching up with him sometime tomorrow and getting in his way. If the girl survived the night, which was unlikely, Matthew stood a better chance of saving her than this inebriated yahoo and a bunch of inexperienced deputies. Matthew had learned that lesson the hard way. Just because men wore fancy stars on their shirts didn't mean they had what it took to face the Sebastians. Tipping his hat, Matthew strode over to the bar and ordered a shot of whiskey. After downing it, he bought a jug to take with him. Then, leaving the saloon, he made his way up the street to the general store to pick up a few supplies for the trail. In order to get inside, he had to clang a cowbell to draw the shopkeeper's attention. While he gathered what he needed, his ears were pummeled by the old man's small talk about how slow his business was and how puny profits had forced him to let go of all his help. "You got a slab of bacon?" Matthew interrupted as he rummaged through a barrel of potatoes. "I need cornmeal and coffee, too." On the off chance that the captured woman survived, he'd need grub to feed her, Matthew reasoned. Not that he believed, even for a second, that she would. If the Sebastian boys held true to form, they'd rape her until the shine wore off and then slit her throat. Eden awakened to a stabbing pain in her stomach, a bad headache, and an awful dizziness. Blinking to see, she realized she'd been slung over the back of a horse, her arms and head dangling. Oh, God! The events of the morning came rushing back, her struggle to escape from that horrible, filthy man, and then sinking into blackness after he struck her. She focused dazedly on the toe of his dirty boot, thrust through a stirrup only inches from her nose. The acrid stench of his unwashed body was so strong, it made her nostrils burn. Moaning, Eden tried to push herself up. With every step of the horse, the saddle horn jabbed her in the middle, and the pain was excruciating. "Be still!" A hard palm connected with her posterior, delivering a sharp sting even through her skirt, petticoat, and bloomers. "I ain't putting up with no sass. You hear?" To Eden's horror, he cupped his hand over her buttock and gave it a squeeze. She bucked and tried to wiggle away, only to be cuffed on the back of her head with such force that she saw stars. "Be still, I say. Maybe you was a highfalutin' young miss this morning, but now you're nothing but a fine swatch of calico I got plans to enjoy." "Take your hands off me, you filthy good-for-nothing. My brothers will hunt you down like the dog you are and kill you for this day's work." The robber laughed and jerked up the back of Eden's skirt. When she felt cool air slipping in through the slit of her bloomers, she shrieked and jabbed him in the side with her elbow. He snarled and grabbed her by the hair. The sting on Eden's scalp brought tears to her eyes. The next instant, he wrenched her head back so far she feared he might snap her neck. But at least he let go of her skirt.
You're a little spitfire, ain't you? I ain't never had me a redhead afore. You gonna fight me, sweet thing? I like a little spunk in my women. Never lasts, of course. Even the spitfires go to squealing and crying after they get poked a few times. But it'll be fun while the fight in you lasts.
When he released his hold on her hair, Eden slumped over the saddle, her head still spinning from the blow to her skull. Despite the pain in her belly from the saddle horn, she decided to take his advice and be still. Fighting him now, when he had her at such a disadvantage, was a waste of energy. She'd bide her time. Sooner or later, they would have to stop and rest the horses. When they did, she'd run the first chance she got. Squealing and crying, he had another think coming. She was no sniveler, never had been, and never would be. No matter what they did to her, she wouldn't give them the satisfaction of seeing her cry. Thoughts of what they might do to her made Eden's blood run cold. Though she'd been sheltered all her life, she was well aware of the danger she was in. Even unmarried ladies shared stories, whispering behind cuffed hands of the atrocities that had been committed against other women. If even half of those stories were true, Eden was in big trouble. She might hold her own against one man, but she would be powerless against five. Only a few minutes later, the men stopped along a stream to water and rest the horses. Eden was tossed from the saddle with no more regard than if she'd been a sack of onions. She hit the damp earth with a bone-jarring thud that knocked the breath out of her. Before she could recover, two of the men grappled her onto her back while a third jerked up her skirts, spread her legs, and knelt between her thighs. As he reached to unfasten his pants, Eden knifed up a knee, planted her traveling boot in the middle of his chest, and sent him tumbling backward with a hard shove.
Hoo-wee! A man holding one of her arms cried. We got ourselves a scrapper.
Eden spit in his face. Touch me and my brothers will kill you. They only laughed at the threat. Though Eden struggled with all her strength, she couldn't escape them. And soon the man she'd kicked was in position again, his trousers hanging open. At the sight of his engorged member, the likes of which she'd never seen or even imagined, Eden nearly fainted with fright. My oldest brother is Ace Keegan, she pushed out tremulously. He's a famous gunslinger, and my younger brothers are just as fast. They'll hunt you down and make you curse the day you were born.
Have to catch us first.
The man in position groped for the slit in her bloomers. She felt his filthy fingers touch her private places.
And we got us a fine talent for not getting caught. Ain't you never heard of the Sebastian gang, girlie?
Eden bucked and shrieked, but he moved forward to impale her anyway. She clenched her teeth, squeezed her eyes closed, and held her breath, knowing it would hurt. But instead, he suddenly fell sideways across her leg. She lifted her lashes to see a fourth man standing over her, feet set wide apart, fists clenched. It was the fellow she'd tangled with right after leaving the train, the one who'd hit her and knocked her out.
We didn't steal the damned girl so you could ruin her, he yelled. We're taking her across the border to Estacado, I said. That old Mexican loves gringo females. He'll pay a small fortune for a redhead.
Oh, come on, Wallace. Eden's almost rapist whined as he rolled onto his knees.
What can it hurt if we have a little fun with her first?
Wallace was taller and stockier than the other four men. He spit a stream of tobacco juice and wiped his mouth with the crusty sleeve of his jacket.
You can have all the fun you want, little brother. But don't go popping her cherry. Estacado likes his women unused, and before he hands over any money, he always checks first to make sure they're virgins.
What fun can we have if we can't give her a poke?
You can play with her all you like, I said. Use your imagination, for God's sake. Just don't let me catch you dipping for honey. When you get to that point, finish yourself off with your hand.
Wallace spit again. His cold gray eyes moved over Eden's body. And hold off on messing with her until tonight. Could be we got a posse on our asses.
Soon as the horses is watered and rested, we need to make tracks.
The moment Eden was released, she rolled onto her side and curled into a ball to hug her throbbing stomach. Mindless prayers circled in her mind. Tonight. The mere thought of those animals touching her made her want to die. Run. She needed to get away. Only the men stayed too close for her to make an attempt. After securing their mounts to nearby trees, they hunkered near her to eat. She could hear one man's jaw popping as he chewed on a piece of jerky. She hadn't eaten since breakfast, but they offered her nothing but a cup of stale water. Eden had difficulty drinking it. Fear had closed around her throat like a brutal fist, but she forced herself to swallow. Then, bruised and shaken, all she could do was lie there, huddled in misery. Soon the men collected their horses. This time Eden was allowed to sit upright in front of the cold-eyed Wallace. At first, she deemed that to be an improvement, but then he looped the reins loosely around the saddle pommel and cupped her breast in his hands. Eden jerked and tried to squirm away. He only laughed at her struggles, tweaking her nipples and then rolling the hardened peaks between thumb and forefinger. Remembering her training sessions with Ace, Eden snapped her head back and nailed him in the mouth. He roared with anger, and the next thing she knew, he dragged her off the horse by the hair and was slapping her. She tried to duck and avoid the blows, but his hold on her hair was relentless, and his strength of arm kept her standing upright. She'd done some damage by butting him in the mouth. Blood dripped from his split lips and collected in the spaces between his decayed front teeth. He swung repeatedly at her face. "Go, Wallace! Show her what for!" one of the other men yelled. "Woo-hoo!" another encouraged. Wallace continued to slap Eden until her face went numb and she could no longer feel the blows. When he finally let go of her, she dropped to her knees, so dazed that her legs had become useless. "Don't you never pull that kind of shit with me again, little girl. Next time I'll strip you naked and lay into you with my belt until my whipping arm gets tired. Then I'll let my brothers have a turn. There won't be a spot on you without welts, including those pretty little tits you don't want me touching." Eden shuddered and bent her head. "Get back on the horse," he ordered. She tried to stand up and couldn't. He caught hold of her hair again and jerked her to her feet. When she failed to mount the horse on the first try, he cuffed her again, then grabbed her at the waist and tossed her up on the saddle. When he swung up behind her, Eden expected him to resume fondling her breasts, but for reasons beyond her, he didn't. She touched her tongue to her puffy lips and tasted blood. One of her eyes was starting to swell shut. Nevertheless, she counted herself lucky. Matters would have been far worse if he had used his fist instead of the flat of his hand. They rode hard until well after dark, which disgusted Eden. Horses couldn't see well during the twilight hours, and most of the horsemen she knew stopped to rest until darkness fell, fearful that their mounts might stumble and possibly break a leg. Not these men. They seemed to care about nothing and nobody but themselves. Much to Eden's regret, when they finally halted to make camp, they built only a meager fire, no doubt because they feared a posse might be close and see the flames. Eden prayed they were right in that assumption, for it might be her only hope. The train had been robbed west of Denver in the foothills, a good day from this city on horseback, and the gang had been heading north ever since at a breakneck pace, covering as much ground as possible. With every minute that passed, they were taking her farther and farther from home and family. By tomorrow at this time, she would be 3 days out from Denver, and four from No Name, located 30 miles south of the larger town. Even if she managed to steal one of the horses and scatter the others, the men might catch up with her before she could reach safety. Eden's silk traveling costume offered little protection against the cold, and she soon felt as if she were freezing. When the man named Harold tossed her a piece of jerky and handed her a tin cup of brackish water, she briefly considered refusing the food and drink. Women in such situations often sought death, but Eden rejected the idea. Her circumstances weren't that dire yet. Determined to sell her across the border for a tidy profit, Wallace had made it clear that no one was to lower her value by raping her. Though Eden wasn't certain what playing with her entailed, she figured she could endure it until she got an opportunity to escape. Shivering with cold while she ate her meager supper, she peered through the darkness at the horses tethered to a high line between two stunted oak trees. She'd learned to ride at an early age, and though she was a bit rusty from lack of practice, she still felt confident in her abilities as a horsewoman. Maybe after the men fell asleep, she could make a run for it. If she took one equine and scattered the others, her captors would be left afoot and unable to give chase. She sent up a silent prayer that no one would think to bind her hands and feet. God had turned a deaf ear. Eden had no sooner sent up that heartfelt plea than the man named Pete advanced on her with two thongs. Though all the brothers resembled one another, Pete stood out in her mind because of the meanness that glinted in his marble-like gray eyes. He jerked her arms behind her back and tied her wrists so tightly that the leather dug into her flesh. Next, he lashed her ankles together. "There's no need to bind me," Eden tried. "Where have I to flee?" He ignored her question. Hunkered near the fire, Wallace called, "Bring her over here so we'll have light. Won't be no fun playing with her in the dark." Pete grasped Eden's left arm and dragged her toward the flames. Unable to walk with her feet bound, she gasped at the pain that lanced through her twisted shoulder as he pulled her over the rough ground, but Pete didn't seem to care. He dumped her beside Wallace and then squatted to stare at her. "She ain't so purty after the wailing you gave her." Wallace's swollen lips twisted in a leer. "Ain't her face we want to play with." With that, he grasped the front of Eden's bodice and drew his knife. With three slashes at the cloth, he laid open her dress. Then he went to work on her camisole. He didn't bother with the corset because it didn't cover her breasts. Eden felt the night air nip at her bare skin. Humiliation coursed through her. She strained against the leather that bound her wrists behind her back, but Pete had tied her securely. She was helpless to defend herself.
"Well now, what have we got here, little lady?"
Wallace asked with an oily chuckle.
"It's been so long since I've seen me any pink tits that I plumb forgot how purty they are." "I want to go first," Pete wheedled. "Go ahead. We got all night. All of us will get a turn. Just remember not to mark her up, and don't lose your head and give her a poke. I got plans for the money Estacado will pay for her. He'll take one look at that face and red hair and froth at the mouth like a rabid dog."
Pete jerked Eden to a sitting position, tossed aside his filthy hat, and bent to take one of her nipples into his mouth. The shock of sensation made her body snap taut, but the leather at her wrists and ankles was so tight that she couldn't struggle. A scream welled at the base of her throat. She swallowed it down. She would not allow these animals to reduce her to that. She felt a filthy hand groping under her skirts.
"Oh, God, no, please, no."
But the hand shoved her knees slightly apart, despite her prayers. In that moment, Eden came face to face with the horror of her situation. All her life, Ace had drummed into her head the phrase, mind over matter. His theory being that a person could live through anything if he had enough strength of will and a plan for survival.
"When life kicks you in the teeth, you hunker down and keep going, no matter what,"
he'd often told her and his younger brothers. Eden had once seen David walk home from a riding accident with a broken leg. He found a tree limb to use as a crutch, and he'd inched his way back for help, every step so painful that he'd almost lost consciousness. Mind over matter. Another time, Ace had taken a bullet in the thigh, and her mother had dug it out of his flesh with the tip of a butcher knife. With no coin for whiskey to dull the pain, Ace had clenched his fists around the headboard of the bed and asked Eden to talk to him about pretty things while Dory fished for the slug. In a quavering voice, Eden had described a meadow in springtime, how the wildflowers nodded in the soft breeze, how sweet the air smelled from their blossoms. Though her other brothers had been ready to hold Ace down, it had never become necessary because Ace had lain there, perfectly still of his own accord, sweat streaming from his twisted face, his glazed eyes focused on nothing while he withstood the agony. Mind over matter. Eden had grown up seeing others in her family set the example, and now it was her turn. She fixed her gaze on the flames and forced her thoughts to faraway places, picturing her mother, brothers, and that meadow she'd once described for Ace when he'd needed something pretty to think about. Let these men do their worst, she thought fiercely. I'm Eden Paxton. I come from good stock. No one is going to make me whimper and beg, least of all miserable worms like these. While they groped and fondled her body, Eden remembered her early days and happy moments on her family's sorry excuse for a ranch on the outskirts of San Francisco. Like the time she'd gotten sick as a very small child, and Ace had hired himself out to empty spittoons, his most despised way of earning money, to buy her a doll. And the time David had bargained at the dry goods store, swapping his only belt to buy her pretty silk hair ribbons as a birthday gift. For months afterward, he'd used one of their mother's sashes to hold his britches up. There'd been sad times, too, of course, like the time her little dog Sam had been run over by a farmer's wagon and died in the road. Afterward, her brothers had dug a grave, and then they'd held a regular funeral, complete with hand-picked flowers, mostly dandelions, and hymns sung in a pubescent blend of breaking voices and deep baritones that Eden would never forget. Dory had culminated the ceremony by reading from the good book. David had followed the readings by assuring Eden that it wasn't only people who could lie down in still pastures. He had claimed Sam was welcome there too, and that after a good rest, he'd be hale and hearty again, racing across the meadows after sticks thrown for him by the angels. As Eden looked back, even the saddest moments in her life now seemed bittersweet, because she'd always had her family to love her, hold her, and ease her pain. The memories calmed her, creating a buffer between her and reality. She thought of Ace's wife, Caitlin, whom Eden so closely resembled, and the couple's boy, little Ace, who'd been a plump darling with dancing brown eyes and a mischievous grin when Eden had visited No Name 7 months ago. Soon she would get to see her niece, Dory, Ace and Caitlin's baby girl, and she'd also be able to visit at length with Joseph's new wife, Rachel, a lovely blonde with beautiful blue eyes. When Eden's thoughts turned to her younger brothers, David and Issa, who still weren't married, she had difficulty focusing, so she jerked her mind back to Ace's children again. Eventually, the torture stopped. The younger Sebastian brothers grew so intoxicated that they staggered away to their pallets, leaving Wallace to drag Eden over to a patch of cold earth beside his bedroll. Before falling asleep, he drew a noose over her head and knotted the loose end of the rope around his wrist. You move while I'm asleep, and I'll wake up. You hear? Eden rolled onto her side with her back to him and brought her knees up to her bare breasts in a feeble attempt to stay warm. Wallace didn't even give her a blanket. Eden could scarcely conceive how anyone could be so uncaring of another human being. But there it was. He'd cut away much of her clothing, and now he meant to cozy down for the night under two layers of wool, while she lay exposed to the elements on damp ground. As the chill of the night air seeped into her bones, Eden stared blankly across the clearing. The small fire had burned down to a mere glow of embers now, providing little light, and the waning moon was hidden behind a layer of clouds that promised more rain. For an instant, tears gathered at the backs of her eyes, but her determination to be strong burned them away. Yes, she had endured the unthinkable tonight, but crying wouldn't undo it or make her feel better. She thought of the wildflowers she and her mother had seen from the train, delicate blossoms surviving in a harsh, unforgiving terrain. She needed to be like those wildflowers. So what if life had brought a storm that threatened to flatten her? Eventually the sun would shine again. She just had to survive until then. In the meantime, rescue was on its way. She knew that as surely as she knew her own name. Ace had recently gotten a telephone. Their mother could call him as soon as she reached Denver. Eden's brothers would waste no time in riding out to find her. God help the Sebastian brothers. Eden hadn't been lying when she'd told them they would come to regret the day they'd been born. Before this was over, they would be the ones who sniveled and begged for mercy. Her brothers weren't cruel men by nature, but if someone dared to harm one of their own, not even the wrath of hell would hold a candle to their anger. That was Eden's last thought as she slipped into a troubled, restless sleep.
And that, my friends, was our reading of Early Dawn by Katherine Anderson, Book 3 of the Coulter Family Historical Books. So, all right, Ghost Dot, what do you think?
Well, since I've heard it before, I think the guys are treating her pretty bad, though, this Eden. I thought they were kind of disgusting.
Yeah, they sure are, and they're... They're of the worst sort, that's for sure. So, we are going to say good night, good evening, and hope everybody will join for the other shows on Station 1. Of course, tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern is 6 and Road, and you call 424-243-9617. Again, 424-243-9617. And then on this station, again, Station 2, 515-605-9340. Tomorrow at 4 p.m. Eastern is the Six Eyes Children's Bible Time at 4 p.m. Eastern. And then at 7 p.m. tomorrow night on Station 1 at 7 p.m. Eastern is the Wednesday Night Bible Study and the Six Eyes Gospel Bus at 7 p.m. Eastern. And you call 424-243-9617. God bless everybody. We'll catch you later.
Oh, well, I thought maybe you could say all about it, but I guess he wants to cut off.